Welcome to Academics of PA. I'm William Hatcher here with Josie Schaefer. How's it going, Josie?
I'm good, Will. How are you? I'm glad to be on with you today.
I'm good. I always timestamp these things by talking about what's going on in my life right now. So I said I wasn't going to do that, but we are busy this week with finals and grading and stuff. So it's a good time to have students on the podcast. And we have two PhD students on the podcast today.
How about y'all introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Hannah Leibovitz. I'm a PhD student in Urban Affairs and Public Administration at Cleveland State University.
Hi, I'm Dante Council. I'm a PhD candidate at Old Dominion University in Public Administration and Policy.
Wonderful. Thanks for being here. We are really excited about the student episode. I think as we've been doing these podcasts, we're realizing that there are lots of pearls of wisdom that we want to share. But then we also really want students' feedback about where it should go and what you want to know and how these can be more helpful, or if they're at all helpful, they might not be. So we're excited to have y'all.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here.
So why don't we start? So I met Hannah at a Midwest Public Affairs Conference. Is that right, Hannah?
I think we met at ASPA last year, actually, 2018 ASPA with Mike Ford.
That actually sounds correct. I apologize. But yes. And you know, first impressions of Hannah was, wow, this girl is doing stuff. She's excited. She's engaged. She wants change. You're really fun. And then we follow each other on Twitter, and you are even more fun on there. And so why don't you talk a little bit about how you came to be a PhD student in public administration and what you want out of that experience?
Wow, sure. First of all, thanks for the compliments. I'm pretty sure my Twitter is just full of me complaining about my kids and being snarky about local government. So nice to hear it's fun for some.
What
people.
Else should it be? That is actually fun.
You have to have cats on there.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really
have. And I'm sorry, the only way I can describe you is fun. I should.
Yeah,
come up with,
you know, I don't have animals because my husband is allergic, right? Isn't that awful? I'm like, you ruined it for all of us. Thank you. But yeah, I should have cats on there. Cats of PA, hashtag. So how did I come to be a PhD student? I actually started off as a practitioner working in local government in New York City, and which is kind of like a small state. It's not really like, I mean, it's a local government, obviously, but it's this ginormous beast. And I worked a lot with people on the ground. So as a street level kind of administrator, doing a lot of constituent services and going to a lot of meetings and representing the councilman that I worked for. And then the councilman that I was working for became the Manhattan Borough President. So I moved over there and I started doing some community development work. And I was just really, really excited about local government, about doing that kind of work, and not really the politics, but the actual policy and administrative work. And me and my husband, we were living in New York, living it up, having fun. And then we decided we wanted kids, and it's super expensive to live in New York with children, like crazy. So we looked into different options, and I got into the Masters of Public Administration program here at Cleveland State. So we moved out to Cleveland, which wasn't crazy because like we're from this kind of area. So we weren't like scared by moving away, although I still cry about the lack of public transit. So that's a big problem. So we moved out to Cleveland. I got my master's. I started working more in the nonprofit field. And then I just kept thinking back to all the work that I had done that was more research heavy. And I just really liked that a lot. So I decided to come back for my PhD. And so now I'm here, and I'm really lucky to be in a program that's really urban focused. So the city is like literally our laboratory, which is really cool if you're a local governance person. So that's where I'm at. That's why I'm here. I also have two kids, and I think that there's this weird like there are weird benefits and also consequences to being a parent while being in academia. In a lot of ways, it's super flexible. In other ways, it's like a huge time suck. So so that's been cool to navigate. And I'm really, really fortunate and very privileged to have a spouse who has a full-time job, which I think really allows for me to be in this space. And yeah, that's my jam. I like talking to people and hanging out with people. So I like going to conferences. But that's just like my thing. And then when I met you at ASPA 2018, I was like, you're so cool. I want to follow you. And you like brought your kids to the conference. And I was like, that's what's up. So everyone bring their kids. Then we'll finally.
I didn't let them hang out with us though.
Yeah, no, that's fine. We were at the bar or something. So
yes, it is a good place to find me at a conference. I'll tell you that.
I think I had a water, just for the record.
Good for you. Awesome. Okay. Dante, why don't you chime in? Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to the field.
Okay. So yeah, my background, how I got into PA. So in undergrad, I did a lot of work with nonprofits. And so I worked with immigrants and refugees to help them assimilate to American culture. And so while I was working with a lot of their clients, teaching them English and really teaching them kind of the norms of American society, I got involved with grant writing and curriculum development with a couple of those agencies. And so I also did an internship with a law firm because I wanted to be an attorney. I actually wanted to be an immigration attorney. And after the internship with the law firm, I hated it, but I knew I wanted to go into the public service and the public sector. And so once I graduated, I went into an MPA program at Jacksonville State in Alabama. And continue to do the work in nonprofit management and program evaluation. And so once I graduated, I worked for a public foundation for several years, also doing grant making. And a lot of my work was focused on participatory grant making and social equity, and really trying to involve nonprofits in the co-creation of ideas and strategies as we were distributing wealth back out to communities. And so I attended the Social Equity and Leadership Conference in 2015 that was held in Tennessee. And I met Drs. Brandy Blessed and Tia Gaynor. And they kind of bullied me into going into a PhD program because they found a lot of the work that I was doing in practice very relevant to some of the uninformed research. And so I had talked with them a little bit. They were great mentors and kind of nurturing me during that process. And so in 2016, I began the PhD program. And so that's kind of how I got involved in becoming a PhD student.
Amazing. Both of you have amazing stories. And I think it's really interesting that you both had this applied experience. You were in the field doing it and felt that a PhD, well, Dante, you said you were bullied into it, but that it could possibly be a way to extend and expand your work. Have you found that the PhD is helping you to do that?
I think that that's a difficult question to answer because it's hard to parse out how much of what we can or do is necessarily connected to, I think, our academic work. I mean, I want to say, I say our like collectively, but I guess I'll say mine. So I think that being a student, having access to the kind of resources that I have has allowed me to do some of the more practitioner focused work. I just don't know that that is appreciated as much in the academy as I think it should be, or that's like equal to the work that I'm putting in. So I'm actually also a journalist here in Cleveland, and I find that I get a lot of attention and I have a lot of resources because I'm a PhD student as well. And I'm able to cover a lot of topics and speak with some level of expertise because of my knowledge and because of the access that I have through university. But at the same time, I don't think that being a journalist is going to help me get a tenure track position necessarily. I don't think that the kind of writing that I do as a journalist or as a reporter would be appreciated in a journal article. So I think that that's where it can be difficult. I also think that just institutional norms like IRB and other processes like that can make it hard to do work that's really embedded in a community. Ethnographic work, field studies, even interviews can be difficult to do. And then their applicability can be questioned in academia in terms of, you know, whether there's subjectivity in the research and all of those kind of issues. So I think there are methodological concerns. I think that there's content concerns. There's writing concerns. So I do think that in a lot of ways I have the ability to do that kind of work as a PhD student and potentially as a faculty member. I just don't know that it's as valued as I wish it was.
There is a lot to chew on there,
Hannah. Sorry.
Dante. Let's get your thoughts and then maybe we can dive in a little bit.
Sure. So I think that a lot of the work that I'm interested in doing, and I think the work that's needed, in at least in PA, I know that at least the first 2 years of my program, I actually spent at non-PA conferences. And so a lot of the work that I was doing, I was presenting at conferences that were maybe a little bit more specific to like natural hazards and disasters, climate change, and social equity. And so those were tracks that I wasn't finding that were really embedded in the PA field. And so although I know that they had implications for PA, I wasn't always sure if it was appreciated by PA. And so I found myself kind of in some subfields or subconferences rather than at ASPA or the conference that you all mentioned earlier. Just because for me, the work that I was doing, although it was related to public administration and policy, it didn't seem to have a good fit with a conference theme or a track specifically. And so I was always cautious about, you know, does my work really fit into the theme of a conference, or will it be relevant and will it be appreciated? So actually this year was my first time going to ASPA. And I see that there was an avenue for some of the work that I really want to dive into, which I'm excited about. But I didn't always feel that way when I started the program, though. And so I'm excited to see like this new call. There's this joint call for papers that was, I think, released yesterday with Public Administration Quarterly and the Journal for Public Personnel Review. They're really is taking a critical lens at looking at issues related to PA and public policy that I don't think I've seen before, which is exciting.
And so I think that, you know, we all sort of grapple with this. What is the right kind of work? What is the kind of work that fits in? I guess I'm wondering, where do you, those cues you've received that suggest maybe your work doesn't fit in, and it does. And I'm not the definitive source on that, but I want to tell you that I think it does. And it, or it should. Like, where did those cues come from, right? How did you realize the norms in the academy, and how did you realize that your work might not fit in right now?
So I think that for me, some of the cues were, particularly within my first year, just looking into the more recent literature. You know, once we get into the foundational classes and learn about Weber and Woodrow Wilson and kind of these seminal pieces related to management, and when we move forward, we still kind of see those same pieces being discussed in different elements or different aspects. But it seemed to be the same type of managerial, public policy related types of literature. And it didn't really relate, have a cultural sensitivity to it, social equity, social justice aspect. And so for me, if we look at, you know, for PAR, for example, which is our top journal, what they publish kind of sets the standard for the field. And so you kind of get an idea of what they're interested in, what's relevant, or what's some of the buzz topics in the field. And if you don't see that presence there, then it can send the signal that it may not be appreciated or wanted, or maybe at the time, or it's just not a good fit. And so for those who are thinking about the tenure track, it's, you know, how do you reconcile your research interests, research that's needed in the field, but also it may not be appreciated by some of the ways that we've institutionalized publishing and what those editors or editorial boards are wanting or requiring. And so for me, that's kind of a way that I've kind of gauged, you know, what is relevant in the field, what's wanted in the field. And so sometimes it hasn't been, to me, always as inviting. But I think there's also a paradigm shift, like I said earlier, where people are starting to see that value and really starting to look at, and I'm a big social equity guy, how do we use that to really promote fairness for people and the people that we serve?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's when I asked the question, I was sort of wondering, is it what you're reading that sort of doesn't include these themes that are important to you and to others? And that is why we sort of know we're not on the inside. Hannah, what about you? What are those cues?
So I definitely think, you know, like just what's being published in top journals, what you're advised to write or to work on if you want to be published in top journals. Those are pretty clear cues. A lot of the focus on methodological, like quantitative methodologies, methodological choices, even in pedagogy, I don't know. I can't speak to the exact numbers, but I don't know how many PhD programs offer qualitative methods courses or even mixed methods courses. But I would tend to assume it's not as many as are offering quantitative. So I think those are the kind of cues in the pedagogy, in the publishing, as to what is valued, what the focus should be on. To Dante's point, I 100% agree, especially in an interdisciplinary program. I spent a lot of time thinking about urban more than local, which might sound odd unless you're an urban person. But a lot of what we talk about in urban planning and urban policy doesn't necessarily match on directly to what PA might call local governance. And I think having even just really simple conversations with people at conferences about, you know, urban and local and all of these different ideas, or thinking about space as opposed to just organizational sciences, where is your local government? Why might that matter? You know, questions like that, I found I was looking at people with blank faces. So I think those are the kind of cues that you get. It could also be me, totally me. I could be crazy. Yeah. But I think those are the kind of cues that you get that make you feel like the things that you study or the interests that you have don't match perfectly with PA. I agree 100% with Dante also that I think that in some ways this is changing pretty significantly, especially from the journal level. Journals like ATP are out there in the front of this, I think, trying to move this administrative theory and praxis. But I still think that a lot of the top journals don't have this mix broadly enough.
Yeah. Will, like thinking on the sort of administrative side, and you know, I think we've talked a little bit about the growth of MPA programs and even PhD and public administration programs. How do those that were trained very narrowly start being great professors and great mentors much more broadly?
It's interesting. One of the common themes that we're getting out of these podcasts from the senior scholars is the lack of methodology diversity in the field. And I don't know, maybe it's our generation or our group, Josie, that came through, because it seems senior scholars and PhD students are looking for diverse methods and getting frustrated with the field's focus too much on quantitative methods. And if it can't be measured and used and ran through a regression model, then it can't be answered. And I think that was something that came out of PhD programs in the 2000s. And
I mean, it's definitely
the
game
it's millennials.
Definitely what I got.
It's all our fault.
Yeah.
No, thank you.
I think it's Generation X that's so reliant or wanting us to be 100% a quant field. I know many of my professors that I had were of the opinion, like many of the folks that we've had on the podcast, that you use your methods that answer your research question. And I think many people who are junior scholars and coming up today have that same opinion too. So you see, like what Dante and Hannah's talking about, where some journals in the field are responding and focusing not just on efficiency, but also fairness and equity, but also on using qualitative and mixed methods, whereas others are still very much locked into if it can't be answered and you plugged into a regression model, then we won't publish it.
And it still has that very like special issue feel, right? Like, well, we're going to let them have this one chance to put that out there, but that's not what we really are all the time. Like the interesting stuff is always a special issue, I think.
I agree. And it's been something that that I've been worried about for a couple of years, and that we've we're relying too much on being heavily over quantitative, and that's not as useful to practitioners. It's not as useful to our MPA students. I constantly have to tell our MPA students that when you're reading a number of these journal articles, the methodology sections are going to scare you. And
well, and I tell them, like, just ignore it. Read the intro and the conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's not exactly what I want them to take from all of that, right?
I think it's a little bit more than also quant versus qual. I think it's also empirical versus interpretive versus critical. I think there's a lot of ways we can cut it up to look at kind of the limitations. But I do definitely think it's changing. I don't want to be like the Debbie Downers, like everything's terrible. But I feel like Gen Xers, like you guys have always felt like you were ignored. So now you're like, we can measure things, so we matter. And millennials are like, whatever, we're cool. But I think there's just a lot of different ways to think about it and to think about whose voices are making it into our publications and who's kind of leading the field.
Well, you gotta think Generation X, we slacked off in the 90s, so we overcorrected by being overly serious in the 2000s.
I hate to get off topic, but I don't know that I'm Gen X. I might need to take a minute and Google that. I think to your point, I do. I think the field grappled with this, oh, maybe we're not an applied field. Maybe we are a research-intensive field. And now we're recognizing that you can be both. And I think I will give the Academy a little bit of credit here. The idea is that journalism is very important, but journalism is not necessarily research. And now I think the writing skills would have to be helpful, right? But that we do want objectivity in research, and we do... Yeah. I mean, I think, right, like not more than that, but just that there is objectivity and that is part of our job too. And maybe we can't always be activists, but I don't know that that's true. I think that's the argument, but I guess as we become a more engaged field, can we be engaged without being critical? And is that a good thing?
I just wanted to clarify about journalism. I didn't mean, obviously, that, you know, anything that I write for a journalistic outlet should be publishable. I meant more that it's a great opportunity that I have as a PhD student. I still have the time. I still have the resources to be a journalist. Like, I think that that's really cool. And I think that being a student allows for that. And I know a lot of people who are students and practitioners. And I think that that informs their research as well. And gives them great opportunities for things. So I don't, and I agree that we want to strive for objectivity in terms of our research. I just don't know that one methodology over another is more objective or subjective, because whatever we're deciding to put into our models can also be very subjective, even when it's based in research and literature. We're making choices, we're making trade-offs constantly as scholars. And owning up to all of that as subjective to some degree is important too, I think. I mean, methodology sections.
Yeah. Good point. Yeah. Right. Even the things we choose to study, that is subjective. And as a result, that's what gets talked about.
Yeah. And this is going to be my last piece on this, but I think even in methodology sections, you can see in like a quant methodology section, there isn't a lot of time or space or words dedicated to justifying why quant decisions are made. But in qual methodology sections, there is so much time that has to go into explaining every single piece of the process and why it's justifiable as a rigorous research method, which is not to say you shouldn't have to do that, but maybe you should have to do a little bit more in quant too, because we're constantly making these decisions and trade-offs.
Right. I don't want to go too negative either, but it's like an important conversation that we have that, yeah, and that we continue to question our role in producing knowledge that is timely and valuable. And I think that's sort of another way to look at it too, right? That the interests should have switched by now, but they don't always seem to when you're reading a top journal. Right? Like the frameworks aren't changing as fast as the times are. Maybe that's the way to say it.
Well, that makes sense because essentially we're supported by our institutions. And so if our institutions, you know, if your peer review or your tenure review process requires you that you publish in certain journals with an impact factor and they value publishing versus service, then you obviously have to cater towards what's going to get you that job security. And so if your institutions don't support that, then obviously there's a trade-off where, you know, I want to do the work, I want to be an activist, but I also need to have a job and like take care of my family. So like those things are really, really hard. But I think that there's also, at least what I saw on the job market this past year, and I'm still new to the job market, there are a lot more clinical positions that are becoming available where they're focus on practice instead of just research. And I think that allows folks that do want to go into academia to have a little bit different approach to their work. And so they can focus a lot more on being in the field and connecting that back to the classroom versus being involved in so much heavy research that they have to make trade-offs. And sometimes that those trade-offs, you're not able to contribute as much as you would like to the field.
Yeah, great. So great point. So what do you see yourself doing in a couple of years? What route do you want to take?
So for me, so I'll be finishing up in just a couple of weeks. And then, so I'll be actually taking a postdoc at American University in their Department of Public Administration.
Yay, congrats.
And so I'm interested in that. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah,
so
congrats.
I'm interested in academia, but I'm also interested in the place that's going to value that I would like to do just as much service as I would like to do research. And so I kind of get a couple of years to figure that out. And so that could be that I may not stay in academia, and it could be in a place where it's some research institute, but I also can do work in communities and be engaged in that way. And so I see myself really being an academic, but I think a scholar activist is what I really kind of characterize myself. And so trying to find that fit, I think at least as a millennial, I want to find a lot of value in my work. And so that kind of gives me that purpose and that drive and motivation to keep going. And so although monies and benefits are great, I also want to find purpose in my work. And so I want to be able to find a place that I can do that for a long time. So
yeah,
academia, probably.
What's the focus of the postdoc?
So actually, this postdoc is actually a diversity postdoc with American. So it's a diversity initiative to have more faculty of color and from underrepresented ethnic groups in faculty positions. And so it's actually focused on teaching.
That is so wonderful. So to your point about sort of segmenting the work, right? At some point, teaching, research, and service to someone appeared to work together really well. But I know coming out, going straight into a tenure track, doing all three well all the time was really hard. And I can see where tenure would have opened that up for me and then allowed me to focus where I wanted to. But it just never felt like you could really give the attention to any one of those that you really had to. So I think a postdoc is just a really good route where you can go in and say, this is what I'm going to work on now. And I'm going to have all of the institutional support, but it's going to be about what I can bring to this. That's great. Congrats.
Yes, I'm looking forward to it. Thank you.
Hannah, what are you thinking?
I definitely want to go the academic route. I really like teaching. I really like research. I really like service. I having been in the practitioner world, I think I have some insight in that way. What I value a lot in the academic world and why I'm willing to continue to push and move in that direction. Teaching is a big deal to me. Also, I think that that's the best way to move the needle, is training the next generation to think differently, to have new ideas, to have really great ideas, and then be able to use a lot of different methodologies, a lot of different frameworks, a lot of different logics of inquiry, I guess you can say, to answer those questions and to pursue those ideas. I think that's really, I think that that's a huge thing for me, teaching. Research is also really important to me. I think that that's also how we change the narrative. You know, you get your publications in, you bring in new ideas, you go through the process. And I value the process a lot, actually. I think it refines your work really well. It gives you those ideas of, you know, what, how you could move the needle ever so slightly with each attempt. And I think we have a lot of great journals where you can really find outlets for your work. I'm also a heavily engaged, for better or worse, scholar activist in terms of community work and being pretty online. So that's a lot of the work that I would like to continue doing, on the ground work, you know, being really active on social media, spreading new ideas, promoting my peers, because that is so huge, just so huge. Like Dante just won an award, shout out for him. And I just want to keep doing that kind of work. So that's the kind of stuff that I want to do. I think the academic world is really valuable for that. I love PA. Like, I have a lot of friends in other disciplines, and I don't mean to like diss the other disciplines, but PA is amazing. And we have a great group. And even people who work on projects that aren't necessarily my projects are really supportive of, I think, a lot of different kinds of work. And that's why I think there's so much potential to move this needle, because I think even what we're seeing at journals or what we're seeing in the classroom isn't necessarily because people don't want it. It's maybe because they don't have the tools to go in a different direction, maybe because they don't have the push, maybe because they're just, you know, just institutional restrictions don't allow them to do that. But we might see, as new people get tenure, as new young people come in, that those are going to shift, because I do think we have a fairly permeable field. I think we're open to change. I think we're open to new ideas. And that's a lot of why I love going to conferences in PA. I mean, social equity was a main theme of ASPA this year, which was awesome. So I do think there's a lot of hope, and I think there's a lot of great stuff going on in academia, and that's definitely the direction that I do want to go in.
Yes, and I do really think that you can do it all, and I don't know any better place to do it all, right? The university gives you that space to do it. So let's talk. So Hannah, when I met you, that was a lot of, I was like, wow, this girl wants it all. And I think I was at a point in my career where I was starting to feel like I could not have it all. I feel pumped again, but it was becoming very difficult to manage the pressures of being especially close to the tenure. The institution was struggling, and we were feeling that at the bottom, butts and seats and all those kind of problems. And so, yeah, I was like, how's somebody going to do it all? But I think you are doing it. I think you're excited to do it. Dante, I think you're being successful doing what you want to do. How can the field, well, let's just take a break on me talking. Hold on a second. I think you can have it all in this field. I think that your generation will be the ones to find the way to do it. I think it might be particularly hard to balance in terms of family. So when I came out, so everyone said, if you get offered a tenure track job, you go. And I have now dragged my husband to all sorts of places he does not want to go. And my kids are born in different states. I don't know if that's a good or bad. I don't know what that means, but you know, we have been willing to move for this job. How do y'all feel about that pressure? And do you think that's going to change? Do you want that to change? And can you sort of have it all, that great working with a great institution and have a great family life or other life?
So, yeah, I think you can have it all. I think it's a lot about trying to manage expectations. I know for me that at least when I was on the job market, location was really important. And so I think I found being at least close to family, at least in this part of my life, was very, very critical to my kind of social support. And so I wasn't really willing to just move. I live in Virginia. I wasn't willing to move to California just for a tenure track. But I do think that there are opportunities, and I think that they come in waves sometimes. It may not be at the exact time. They kind of really meet all of those, all of the things that you're looking for. But I think it is a bit of a struggle, though, because in a lot of places there aren't the undergraduate programs for PA. And so that kind of limits us a little bit to where we can go. And so that's kind of a limitation. But I also think that MPA programs are growing across the nation. And so I think there'll be a lot more availability as far as tenure track positions in the future. So I think there's a middle ground for everyone. At least I think so.
So my hot take is you can't have it all. I think you can have it all, but not at the same time, rather, I should say. So I think that there are different periods of time, even within the year or over your life, where you have to make different sacrifices and where you make different things priorities. But then potentially when you look back, you know, at some point you've had it all to some degree. I think a lot about, I have two kids, two little ones. I have a 4.5-year-old and a 2-year-old. Follow me on Twitter for adorbs pictures of them. And my 4.5-year-old is sassy. Wow. So a lot of what I think about in terms of their diet is, like, I don't think about it as a day at a time. I think about it as a week at a time. So some days, you know, they'll eat mostly carbs. Some days they'll eat some protein. Some days they'll eat some vegetables. And by the end of the week, I'm like, yeah, they're pretty balanced. Everything's pretty okay. They're going to be fine. And then, you know, at your yearly checkups, you have checkups with your doctor, and your doctor says, yeah, they're pretty okay. So it helps you to see that maybe even at one point in time, they're eating junk food, but that's not kind of their whole life. That's not their entire panel of health. So that's what I think that's a lot about. Yeah. And so I think a lot about, like, the academic world in that way. I think that you can have it all. You just can't have it all at the same time. And we're fortunate in the academic world that our year is kind of chopped into at least three parts. So we have fall, spring, summer. We have different periods where we can, you know, we have conference seasons. We have these time periods where we can really think about what we're going to invest in. And then, you know, over tenure track time period, you do have time to do a lot of work. So, you know, your first 2 years, you might not have all the publications out, but then they start coming out, or, you know, you have time to do things. And I think that's important. Where I think that we have institutional barriers are, personally for me, related to maternity leave or paternity leave, parent leave, I should say. In terms of just crises coming up with your family, and then also just regular things like births and recovery. I don't think that we have enough support for those, or for breastfeeding, or for, you know, a lot of these other kind of parenting experiences that we do feel as a society are valuable to a certain degree if a parent chooses to, if it works for a family. So I think that that's where we maybe as an institution need to shift a little bit. I know that a lot of tenure tracks do give, you know, a semester off or something for maternity leave, but I don't know that they do for all parent leave, or I don't know if they do for adoptions, or, you know, these are the kind of conversations that I think we do need to have more about institutional barriers for family life. But I think that if you look back at a large time period, you might find that you've had it all. But at one point in time, thinking that you have it, that you can have it all, is just going to lead you to be looking at your list of things and start tearing up because it's just impossible. But I think overall you can.
So much wisdom.
I know, Hannah. I want to be like you when I get older.
I can hear that from you guys because my kids think I'm the worst. My daughter just told all her cousins that your mommy's not mean because my mommy is the meanest. So nice to have you guys around. It's okay. I'm kind of proud of it. I don't know. Is that bad?
Yeah. No, you have to do it, right? Like when they like you, that's when you know there's a problem.
Right? Right?
One of the things talking about you that's, it's for one, it's really refreshing to have Hannah and Dante so excited about the work and careers in public affairs. I think many times when we get in the tenure track and then tenured or in our full-time positions, we get kind of jaded. So it's very refreshing to have that. And talking about balancing it all, we as a field, what can we do? You know, if you could think of 2-3 things that we as a field can do to help PhD students as they're coming out, help them with their career paths, help them balance life and family. What can we do?
So I'm not too sure right now as a field. That's probably a really complicated question. But I can say that, at least from my experience, so my faculty, so my dissertation chair and my advisor have been extremely critical to really nurturing my path and post-grad aspirations. And so my chair has been really supportive as far as financial support when it comes to traveling to conferences and really trying to expand my networks. She's been really good with connecting me to the folks that have similar interests or may have opportunities moving forward. And so having a very active and compassionate mentors have been really, really critical. And so, you know, when I think about the programs such as like the ASPA's Founders Fellows Program and things like that, those are really critical to really creating that network and that foundation and navigating the job market and creating getting your feet wet in the field with your first job. I think it's really critical. And so when I think about support in those ways, I'm pretty sure that there are lots of other programs that are non-PA, but even maybe expanding the Founding Fellows program a bit to include more PhD students, because that development I see across, and it's not just unique to PA, but that institutional development or that internal support isn't available to everyone. And so some of us have to go out and seek external support in order to have that type of nurturing and growth to really make the right connections and know what are some of the unwritten rules of the field. Like, you know, what are some of the things you don't say to people at conferences? What can you say to people at conferences? Who do I talk to? It's so funny. The first conference that I went to, and this is actually in Tennessee. I wasn't even in the program just yet, but I was talking with someone. I didn't know who he was. But he was asking me about my MPA program and one of the classes that I had taken, ethics. And I said, oh, I hated that class. It was horrible. And he actually ended up being the author of the book that we used.
Oh, man.
and so it's like, okay, I'm glad that I wasn't in the field.
You were just being critical.
I was. The book wasn't horrible, but it was just a very boring read. And I still believe that. And I think there were other ways that we can be innovative in the ways that we approach our work and pedagogy, nonetheless. But just kind of knowing how to navigate a lot of those spaces is really critical because it's really about who do you know and who knows you. And also creating that pipeline for publications. And so I'm not too sure. I know that it's as a graduate student or as a novice scholar, much of the responsibility is on yourself to go out and really, you know, pursue your research agenda. But even just navigating that process, I know for me, I was lucky enough to really have great mentors and faculty that I could collaborate with to position myself on the market. But I see that's not, those opportunities aren't present for everyone. And because everyone doesn't want to go into academia, but I see a lot of students that do struggle in that area. So I'm not too sure how that can happen. I'm not too sure if we even have journals that are meant for novice scholars that are more introductory rather than trying to publish in PAR or ATP coming straight out. because I think that pressure sometimes is a little bit overwhelming when you're still trying to figure out how the heck am I going to get through a dissertation, let alone produce some novice research in a top journal that honestly, if it's just really difficult. And so that's kind of my thoughts. I'm not even too sure if I answered the question, but those are just
no. I actually think that was great, right? Like, what can we all be doing to be better mentors, better teachers, provide the right support, you know, and right? Like, what PhD students needed 10 years ago is probably really different than what they need now. And so how can we think about being the right, what is the right kind of support?
Yeah, I think for me, to Will's question about two things, I actually have three, if that's okay. I know it's usually the opposite, like, you know, list three things, then pick two. So I was told to list two, so I'm picking three. I think for me, the three biggest things are funding, transparency, and enthusiasm. I think that we need a lot more grants in public administration, like a lot more, especially for students who are struggling in the program, even to get to a conference because of their lack of funding. Students who are you know, on a single, again, you know, come from low income households. Like, there's just a ton of privilege that we assume people have in terms of money to be able to attend a conference or even to be able to dedicate the time to do research on the side, additional research to be able to publish. Because sometimes the papers that we write, let's say, you know, in coursework or even early papers that you write out of your dissertation aren't perfect for a publication yet. And spending that time to put in to get something publication level, that also costs money. So I think funding is huge. Transparency, I actually think of really in terms of being open and honest about the every single process, like, for example, the research process. In the beginning, I definitely thought that there's this really easy way to go through the research process. You know, you come up with a question, you look at the literature, you find the data, blah, blah, blah. But it's really this massive, like, mess. And I think that being more open about that, being more open about the struggles that you have, even as a researcher further along the line, being more open about imposter syndrome that that are, you know, tenured and full professors might have is really important. And then just be enthusiastic. Like, if you meet a grad student who's in his or her first year and they're at a conference, and even if they say something ridiculous, just be like, I believe in you. You're going to do great. Keep going. Keep working at it. Find one thing that a student says or that a student does that really has the potential to continue to grow, because you have no idea, you know, that student could have an off day. That student might actually not yet have the threshold or the capacity to be at the level that they should be, but they can. They can catch up. They can move forward. So just be enthusiastic. Just, like, there's no reason for a senior scholar to show up to a panel and, like, be negative or be nasty. Like, there's just nothing to gain from that, in my opinion. So I think those would be
getting offended about their crappy books.
Yeah, no, but even that, like, honestly, I mean, like, that's kind of a bad move, Dante, sorry. But but even that, like, if I were the professor, you know, like, what do you, I mean, I don't know how he or she responded, whatever, but I definitely would just be like, okay, cool. Like, I get that you didn't appreciate that. That might not be your thing. Tell me about what you are interested in. You know, and that kind of, like, pivot doesn't seem to be really difficult for me to imagine. But I've seen so many times just grad students get crushed for what seems like no reason.
That's one of the reasons I really like our field, though, is we're really supportive compared to other social science fields, especially political science. And when you go to our conferences, it's not, but there are people who maybe negative and who aren't as supportive.
You know, they call Will the Crusher Hatcher, right?
Wow.
He's a dream crusher.
Will is amazing.
Crush you with the silliness and laughing.
I think that I have seen both sides of the field. And I think probably maybe less aggressiveness, but there can really feel like an insider-outsider perspective. And I don't know that it is actually true, but until I really started engaging at conferences in what way was a different way for me, right? I thought you showed up, you did your thing and everyone would go, wow, you're impressive because that work is important. And I still wish that was always true and like everyone would recognize the work, but it was a little bit of, they really are opportunities for network and discussion and what else. And it, you almost have to approach them kind of humble, right? Like, I don't know, you who do teach me. And that was a game changer for me because then I really met people who could teach me. But I think before that I felt like an outsider, like you didn't get it. You didn't know what you were supposed to get out of it. Yeah. Yeah. You need some mentoring.
Hey, this is Dante. I was going to say, I actually have to jump off.
We're coming up on time.
I have a meeting also.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, hey, this was a great conversation. It went really fast and I didn't even realize we were at the end. Thank you all so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. I really appreciate it.
Bye, everybody.